Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Brian Lukacher, professor of art at Vassar College, who's here to talk with us about the subject of his new book entitled Joseph Gandhi, an Architectural Visionary in Georgian England, published by Thames and Hudson. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Thomas.
Your book is the first full-blown study of an artist who, until now at least, seems never to have received his critical or historical due, which I find remarkable, for as your beautifully illustrated book makes clear, Joseph Gandhi was an extraordinarily gifted artist who had a special talent for absorbing and reflecting all the complexities of an extraordinary period in British and European history. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, part of the appeal of the project was that, aside from some essays about Gandhi written in the 1940s and 50s by John Summerson, there was nothing about Gandhi, and he didn't leave much of a paper trail. It was this recovery of what seemed to me a kind of lost genius of architectural design and architectural theory of the Georgian period that intrigued me so much. When I began doctoral research on Gandhi, my topic was actually a broader one. It was going to deal with architectural fantasy as a genre of British romantic painting, and it was going to incorporate discussions of Turner and John Martin, and even architectural motifs in the work of William Blake, for example. But I began with Gandhi, and Gandhi's material that I was able to excavate over the first years of my periods of research grew and grew, and it soon became apparent that Gandhi deserved to have his own monographic treatment. One of the key elements of my research and my publications on Gandhi, including this monographic study, had to do with recovering the critical reception of Gandhi in his own time. And what was so extraordinary was the discovery that he was widely acknowledged as a genius within his own historical epoch, and that his reputation, the controversies surrounding him, were actively debated in the leading journals, magazines, art reviews of the period, and that he, in a sense, disappeared during the 1840s, was resurrected by Summerson, a great architectural historian who was the curator of the Soane Museum in the 40s and 50s, and then I came along in the 1980s and 90s.
You mentioned that in his own time, Gandhi was widely appreciated, but he himself felt that his contemporaries failed him in this respect, and he did not receive the credit and certainly not the architectural commissions he felt his genius warranted.
From the very beginning in Gandhi's writings, his letters to his father when he's a student in Rome in the 1790s, all the way through his private correspondence, there is, how shall I say it, he suffers from a persecution complex. He's convinced of his own greatness very early on, and he almost revels in his outcast status. It's a kind of construction of a melancholic, romantic personality type that he seems intent on cultivating, despite the fact that it led to a difficult life of suffering and family tragedy. As I describe in the book, he had a large family. Yeah, he and his wife had 9 children, 3 of whom died before the ages of 3. He was in and out of debtor's prison on 2 occasions, and he was always asking for advances from his pension fund from the Royal Academy, where he exhibited his works and where he was a student. But nonetheless, he seemed almost to cherish his strange outcast status within the context of Georgian art and architecture of the early 19th century.
Happily, a substantial body of his work has survived, partly due to his association with John Soane, his employer and, in some respects, partner and alter ego. And as this is a program where we hope to elucidate, among other aspects of scholarship, the processes of scholarly research, I wonder if you could tell us something about how you went about doing your research.
Sure, of course. Well, as you mentioned, John Soane, one of the leading practicing architects of the early 19th century in Great Britain, he was most renowned for being the architect to the Bank of England. Soane, before he died and over the last 20 years of his life, established a kind of domestic museum in London, in Holborn, where he housed his collection of antiquities and architectural fragments. And when Soane died, he bequeathed this domestic museum, Sir John Soane's Museum, to the British government with a generous allowance. And, of course, it still exists, and in fact, its popularity has rocketed in the last year. So Sir John Soane's Museum was, in a sense, my research base. Gandhi worked for Soane as a draftsman and produced many drawings that Soane would exhibit under his own name. Soane bought very few Gandhi drawings that reflected Gandhi's interest. But what had happened in the 20th century was that descendants of Joseph Gandhi began to donate drawings that they had found in their attics, under their sofa beds. Mm-hmm. They would find these works and donate them to the Soane Museum. So there are about 15 major works by Gandhi that were, shall we say, Gandhi's, not Gandhi drawings of Soane's architecture, that were at Sir John Soane's Museum. Then for me, it was a matter of just sleuthing, going through auction house catalogs, looking at sales catalogs that stretch back to the 1920s. Oftentimes, Gandhi's works would be misattributed to John Martin, or even, I recall, I discovered a drawing in a collection in Amsterdam. The owner of the drawing thought it was a John Soane, and when I looked at the drawing, there was someone had signed Turner in the lower left-hand corner. So, in a sense, Gandhi's authorship seemed to always be in question. Mm-hmm. And so it was a matter of me parsing through the catalogs of the auction houses, contacting further descendants. At one point, I spent time in the British Library looking at phone books for the major UK towns and cities, and simply wrote down the phone numbers of every Gandhi I could find and systematically called them and introduced myself as an American scholar doing research on Joseph Gandhi. Of course, the variety of responses were was quite strange. Some of the Gandhis I reached thought I was a madman and summarily hung up on me. But
did these people know Joseph Gandhi?
They were utterly unaware of who Joseph Gandhi was. Sure. But fortunately, during periods of my research, there were three or four descendants who had collections of Gandhi material, papers, letters, and they had always been intrigued by the reputation and the activities of their ancestor. So they became, in a sense, close contacts and also friends of mine over the last 20 years
of
my research.
So documents weren't really cataloged then?
No. I recall in 1985, I visited Miss Rosalie Gandhi, who lived in Heathfield in Sussex. She was in her 80s, and she lived alone, and I had gotten her address through another Gandhi who lived in Hampton Court, and I called her, and she invited me down for tea one afternoon. So a friend of mine, we drove down, and she had two Gandhis on the wall, and at one point she got a stool and climbed up into the closet and pulled down a shoebox.
Oh, good Lord.
And there were letters from Gandhi to his son that he wrote just before he disappears in the late 1830s. There were copies of calling cards. I have a copy of Gandhi's business card from the 1820s. And this was just piled in a shoebox that she had stored away at the top of her closet. So this was very much a hands-on research project. I had to, in a sense, construct and reconstruct my own archive piecemeal over the years.
A related theme of our program has to do with the nature of libraries and archives and the way they provide for the creation and transmission of culture and memory. And the series of Gandhi's pictorial works that seem, to me, to address these questions directly are his renderings of the interior of John Soane's house and museum, which is, of course, itself an archive that Soane put together to perpetuate his own legacy. And in particular, I was interested in the work that's entitled Selections of Parts of Buildings Erected from the Designs of John Soane that Gandhi did in 1918, which depicts models and Gandhi's own renderings and other materials of Soane's work. Mm-hmm. And what struck me about it is it's a work that is in itself an archive, and that it documents these things, and it documents an archive. So he seems to be working with this notion of the library, the repository of the past.
Yeah. Now, both Gandy and Soane were haunted by the problem of historical memory. They're concerned with archaeology, with excavating the origins of culture and architecture from the past, but simultaneously they're concerned with the whole problem of futurity and trying to anticipate the future efforts to recover their present, which will of course eventually be a past. And therefore, both Soane and Gandy had what might be called a kind of compendious imagination. Their drawings and designs often involve an incredible sense of plenitude and of collecting specimens within one visual image. And the drawing to which you allude is one of Gandy's most famous drawings. It's adorned any number of British novel covers over the last 10 years, and it's visually striking primarily because of the fact that it's set in an interior Soane-like space, but the only source of light within the view within the drawing. I know it's hard for listeners to experience this drawing ekphrastically, as it were, but the only source of illumination is this huge studio lamp that shoots forth with these brilliant beams of light within an otherwise dark, tenebrous space. And the impulse behind this drawing, well, there are multiple impulses. At a personal level, Soane's wife had just tragically died. Uh-huh. And Soane was in a protracted period of melancholic mourning. And in some sense, Gandy wanted to cheer him up with this strangely haunting image in which the greatness of Soane would be canonized in this compendious archive of Soane's designs as represented in Gandy's pictures and by these gargantuan models. And you'll notice over the left-hand corner, one of the monuments is the Soane family tomb, uh-huh. which has a mourning cloth over it. So in some sense, the drawing is an effort on Gandy's part to bring Soane about and to bring him around to a realization of his creative potential and what he's accomplished up to that point. But at the same time, there is also a kind of morbid, dark historical vision that is inscribed within the very moodiness of the drawing and of the tenor of the view. Now, simultaneously, Gandy was interested, and Soane shared this interest, wanted to show that architecture was not merely a building, mm-hmm. that architecture was a kind of figment of the imagination, the way a poem or a painting or a mental image functions in that way.
There's an elision here, of course, of the model of the image, that shows an interest, certainly in illusionism, especially in the dramatic lighting. And there's something theatrical about the work, too.
No doubt about it.
The Soane's buildings are all getting up and
performing.
In a theatrical space.
Now, this problem of what I think could probably be called a kind of special effects mentality in the way that Soane and Gandy conceived of architectural design and the staging of how one views buildings. This is a consequence of the rise of the picturesque aesthetic in the late 18th century. This is an important theme that runs throughout my book. Frequently, Gandy's own drawings in the contemporary press are compared to phantasmagoric theaters, pantomimes, all kinds of special effects entertainments, panorama views that were part of mass media culture in the early 19th century. These are the prototypes for cinema and, as I said, the kind of special effects entertainment culture that we think of in more modern terms.
Speaking of mass media and special effects, one of the people you thank in your acknowledgments is Ray Harryhausen, the great illusionist and illustrative genius of 20th century cinema.
This shows how strange fate can be, because as a child, my favorite movie was, of course, Jason and the Argonauts, which was one of Ray Harryhausen's masterpiece. Ray Harryhausen was a student of the special effects master of King Kong. And Harryhausen in the 60s made special effects movies, The Seven Voyages of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts. And I loved Clash of the Titans came a little bit later, but I loved these movies as a child. So in 1983, I had organized a small exhibition of Gandy's drawings in London. And out of the blue, I received a letter from Ray Harryhausen. He had gone to the exhibition And he wrote me to say that he had a huge painting, an oil painting, that had been sold to him by Charlotte Frank, who was a picture dealer in London in the 1960s. It had been sold to him as a John Martin, another one of these apocalyptic romantic landscape painters of the 1820s and 30s. And he saw the exhibition I'd organized and was convinced that his picture was not Martin, that it was Gandhi.
Oh, interesting.
So it took us a couple of years. It adorns the cover of the book, Jupiter Pluvius of 1819, 1820.
So you attributed it then?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was able to match it up with a catalog entry, and also in terms he exhibited at the British Institution. The catalogs of the British Institution had scale, so I was able to match it to the scale.
And it's a very Harryhausen-esque image.
Exactly.
I have to say.
No, it's this marvelous Greco-Roman architectural vista set in a sublime mountainous setting, which indeed is very close to the imagery of Jason and the Argonauts and Clash of the Titans.
Titanic figure of,
exactly.
Jupiter.
So it took a couple of years for us to get together because he was oftentimes vacationing in Portugal or North Africa. But finally, about 2 years later, I visited him and had dinner at his house in Holland Park and saw the Jupiter Pluvius, which he had just had restored. The painting, I should say, is enormous. It's a large-scale work, and it's one of Gandhi's rare oil paintings. Most of the time, Gandhi worked in wash drawings, not in oil and canvas. But this was a part of Gandhi's efforts to gain his reputation as a landscape painter, not simply as an architectural draftsman. So Harryhausen was very excited to have the drawing assigned to Gandhi, and it's now, as you say, it adorns the cover of the book. So it was a serendipitous meeting of the minds, as it were. And he has other paintings that also show his interest in these romantic strains of the imagination. He has a wonderful Gustave Doré painting in his home. And at one point, he also took me up into his study, where he has all the old models of the various creatures from all of his movies. Everything was there. All of the models of the mythological creatures, the supernatural beings that occupied his films and that were filmed, as you know, in this stop-action animation. So these creatures had to be generated out of movable wax parts. And so I spent time looking at these models. So he had his own archive, his own fantastic archive up on the third floor of his home.
Another space that Gandhi documented and seemed to be especially interested in when he was doing his topographical studies was Roslyn Chapel, recently made famous by Dan Brown's book.
You mean the Roseline Chapel?
The Roseline Chapel. And you've seen it on the Discovery Channel.
A million times.
You can find
Roseline Chapel on TV now at 24/7.
Exactly. And he uses it later as a basis for fanciful work on the Tomb of Merlin. And I wonder if you could talk about that work, the Tomb of Merlin, and a little more maybe about Gandhi's obsession with obsequies, funerary monuments, tombs, cinerary urns, cenotaphs, crypts, and all things having to do with a funereal.
It's a leitmotif that runs throughout his career. But before I do that, I want to back up a second and explain why Gandhi was interested in Roslyn Chapel. And this actually has some connections to Vassar College in a funny way, which I'll get around to. You see, there's a whole secret system that insinuates everything around the world of Joseph Gandhi. It's part of an occult integrity. But anyways, Gandhi for many years worked for an antiquarian scholar and publisher named John Britton, who undertook a systematic survey of medieval architectural remains throughout Great Britain. And Britton gave Gandhi commissions to travel to various sites to do drawings of these monuments that would then be engraved or etched into his compendious multi-volume series, the picturesque antiquities of Sussex, etc., whatever. Gandhi became very interested in Roslyn Chapel because, as Gandhi wrote, and I hear I'm paraphrasing, it seems to be a medley of many historical styles. He thought it was a kind of composite of Saracenic Arabic architecture, Moorish architecture, late Roman architecture, early Christian architecture, and flamboyant Gothic. Gandhi thought of Roslyn as encapsulating a kind of interesting microcosm of divergent architectural styles. And then, of course, he was also haunted by its legends, the Freemasonic myths surrounding the site, because the Roslyn clan, that was the family of the St. Clairs, who were renowned for introducing Freemasonry into Scotland back in the 15th century. And there were legends about hauntings and intrigue among the master masons who were responsible for the designing of the ornate decorative vocabulary of forms that you find at Roslyn Chapel. And so this notion that an architectural site, again, has this almost mystical occult lineage is something that Gandhi finds absolutely irresistible. Mm-hmm. And linked to that, of course, the idea of the sepulchral, the mortuary, of creating an object that will, as it were, shine forth and illuminate the future. It will mark the presence of something long gone into an unknown future.
Yeah, and in this Merlin's tomb, there is this light.
The Tomb of Merlin, a drawing that he does in 1815, 1816, right around the same time that he's doing the composite view of Soane's architecture that we've already talked about, he takes the archaeological detailing that he had done for John Britton at Roslyn and incorporates it into a poetical view of the interior of Merlin's tomb as described by Ariosto, the Renaissance epic poet, who sought to convert the Arthurian legend into this epic. And Merlin has been murdered by a sorceress, but of course he's not truly dead, and his spirit is entombed within this sarcophagus. Mm-hmm. And he speaks from within the tomb, and his main role is as a prophet. And in the drawing in question, again inspired by Ariosto's epic poem, Bradamante, a female knight, has stumbled into this underground cavernous chapel and pays homage, kneels down in front of the tomb, and the light, the tomb illuminates, and the illumination signifies Merlin's voice. And what he's saying to her is that within your womb is a generation of future kings. So it's this notion that a voice from the dead will speak through a commemorative monument and hold out the promise of the future. But let me come back to a question.
Also kind of metaphor for the library and what libraries are.
Of course. Exactly. Archives of long-lost, musty material that is reanimated for the future. Now, I want to bring this back a little bit to Vassar just for a minute, just in terms of anecdotes. John Britton, this antiquarian topographic scholar who was a close friend and colleague of Gandhi's, and by the way, he was a close friend of Soane's. He wrote the first book about the Soane Museum in 1828. Soane was unhappy with it and bought up all the copies he could and then wrote his own account of his own museum in 1832. Soane was a bit cranky and cantankerous as an individual. Basically, an important part of the Vassar Library and the founding collection of the Vassar College Museum, which was housed on the top story of main building, all of that material was purchased from the estate of John Britton in the 1850s by Elias Magoon, who was a member of, who was the trustee of Vassar College. Yes, that's where all of it came from. He had agents in London buying every lot that they could of from John Britton's estate after Britton died in 1853. And in fact, that's why Vassar, the Vassar Art Museum, the Lehman Loeb Art Center in its current incarnation, has a handful of Gandhi topographic sketches because they came through Britton's estate.
Apropos of Gandhi's interest in the funereal, I found fascinating your mention of a lost plan to turn what seemed like half of London into a great cast iron necropolis.
Yeah. And of course, I imagine even Gandhi felt that he would ever see realized.
This was certainly, at this point and at the end of his career, it was a totally speculative, almost like a kind of science fiction drawing. But it's one that I've been so desperate to find. It's one of many of his most intriguing drawings that have yet to surface. It's possible that it may yet surface, especially after the appearance of this book, after maybe someone in their country house realizes that that lumbering drawing of a cast iron pyramid or monument that they've had in the back hallway is actually a lost Gandhi drawing. But at one point, when I was visiting with John Gandhi, who sadly died before this book came out, I spent time with him looking at old family photos of his father and grandfather's house and country house in the hope that perhaps we could see, you know, missing Gandhi drawings on the walls of the picture recording these photographs, because he had a dim memory that perhaps his grandfather had owned the drawing of the cast iron tomb that Gandhi executed. Gandhi, after 1825, is really highly vexed by the travails of urban growth in London, and he was hardly alone in this. London underwent rapacious industrial technological changes in the 1820s and 1830s. It was the largest city in the world, the metropolis of the world, as it was called. Remember that in the 1830s, Paris was one-third the size of London, both in terms of topography and in terms of population. Mm-hmm. And by the 1830s, pollution, urban crime, the accumulation of cholera, ridden contagion, sewage piling up in the Thames. These were all part of urban experience. And Gandhi writes with some anxiety about all of these changes. And one of the concerns, and it was not his alone, was this problem of how are you going to deal with the disposal of the dead in these highly concentrated urban centers. And so what we know about this drawing is the paragraph account that he gives of the drawing that was the title and that was published in the Royal Academy exhibition listing. And in this paragraph, he describes that this is going to be this huge cast iron monument, like a tower, that was to hold thousands of little apertures that would contain these metal cylinders into which each corpse would be placed. So imagine a kind of ancient Assyrian or ancient Egyptian monumental tomb, but recast in terms of the most modern utopian materials.
Yeah, strange mixing of the archaic and the technologically futuristic.
Yeah, no, it's again, I can't even imagine what the hell this thing must look like. this strange drawing.
The drawing itself, I can't imagine. Yeah.
And it's vexed me that I wasn't able to find it.
Now, just to give an idea of the range and variability of Gandhi's work, I was also quite astonished at the domestic and agricultural structures that appear in his pattern books, many of which you illustrate, that seem to jump from the architecture of his own period right to the 20th century.
Well, it's curious that those works, these two books of designs that he published in 1805, that some of these works were, in a sense, his most well-known works in the 20th century. Mm. Scholars in the 40s and 50s actually picked up on these pattern books and referred to them because of the fact that they seemed to look like
Frank Lloyd Wright
or Corbusier or any number of A-styler international style buildings.
These long horizontal structure with rectangular horizontal windows, very modular looking.
In Gandhi's view, obviously, he would have defined these as primitivizing, as elemental. Yeah. Let me set up the social context for these designs a little bit, if I may. It's 1803. Gandhi's back in London. The Napoleonic Wars are raging. Very little building is going on. So what's an architect to do? Gandhi was part of a large trend where young architects were promoting designs for domestic small-scale buildings, both for an emerging bourgeois suburban clientele and also for a gentry who wanted to bring improvement to their farms and to the conditions of the habitations of their rural laborers. And so Gandhi and others began to issue these pattern books of ideal designs. And part of the impulse here, especially in dealing with the issue of housing the rustic workforce, mm-hmm. part of this was, of course, to try to avoid the social revolutionary unrest that had gripped France in the prior 20 years. That is, to forestall a revolution from beneath. It was thought that the social environment and the living conditions of the laboring classes had to be improved. And that's what Gandhi argues in the preface to these books, mm-hmm. that these designs were going to bring a modicum of civilization, of cultivation, to an underclass that had never been attended to in terms of their living environment. Now, when he was in Italy in the 1790s, Gandhi writes to his father about the fact that he's digging into the countryside of the Abruzzi, mm-hmm. The mountainous terrain north of Rome, and he's looking at vernacular architecture. He's looking at small villas, farmhouses, barns, and he's sketching these, and he says, I'm going to do something with this later. So when you look at these wonderfully streamlined, antiseptic elevations in his pattern books, it's a combination of this problem of purifying architecture, taking it back to its root elements, incorporating the best of vernacular architectural forms that he had studied in Italy, and then reapplying them into the context of this utopian reform movement of the picturesque cottage circa the first years of the 1800s. But they're still absolutely striking in the way that they seem to miraculously leap from the early 19th century into the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in terms of the idiom of design that they put forth. Yeah. Sadly, nothing came of them.
And these are some of Joseph
Gandhi's few architectural designs that actually do seem buildable.
No, they're quite feasible in terms of scale. They don't have any of the megalomaniacal, antique-inspired extravagance that you see in most of his architectural landscapes. And, you know, he includes floor plans and specifications of building materials and even the cost for each one, according to the, obviously, the standards of materials and their expenses in 1805. But I have not found any evidence that anybody ever built any of these.
It's interesting to speculate if they had been built on and had been critiqued at the time, that they may have actually changed the course of domestic architecture in England, if not Europe.
It's quite possible, but that's, again, a history that never came to pass.
Gandhi also did a series of emblematic pictures, very much in the style of William Blake, which tell us more about his religious and cultural eclecticism, which seems a very contemporary attitude. And there's a lot about Gandhi looking through his works that does strike you that way, that he, in some ways, he appeals to a modern sensibility.
Well, at the end of his life, at the end of his career, in the mid-1830s, he embarked on a series of drawings. Some of these are what you're referring to, that he called comparative architecture. And these were going to be a set of drawings. He thought that he announced that they were going to constitute a set of 1,000 drawings charting the intertwined history of architecture and religion and mythology. So in some ways, indeed, like Blake, he's interested in the way that tectonic form is connected to the spiritual history of humanity. Simultaneously, remember, he has 1 foot in the early Victorian age. Yeah. You know, he's exhibiting these in 36 to 38, mm-hmm. Which is the very outset of Victorian of the Victorian period. And the idea of, again, of compendiousness, of trying to create these images in which entire civilizations and their historical formation could be concretized in one image, in order to concentrate the didactic, instructive function of the picture. This is something that obsessed Gandhi. And it's hard. I can't really bring a descriptive language to these images because they're so full. I mean, I tried to do so in the book.
Like symbolic works.
Yes, but he was, you know, I don't mean to turn Gandhi into a kind of post-structuralist, but he was interested in the variability of architectural form and its signifying power, and how we cannot understand architectural form, ornament, the variety of the orders, the distinction of architectural styles without understanding the religious, mythic foundations of the culture that produced it. And so he was very intent that his early Victorian audience have a broader understanding of architecture as a signifier of religion, myth, and the foundations of human culture.
And is this related to his large written project?
Yes. One of the discoveries I made during the course of my research was that I was in touch with a descendant of Joseph Gandhi, who, upon receiving a letter from me, she just went up in the attic to dig around to see if she could find anything, and she just happened upon a box that contained these manuscripts.
So this wasn't in the library or
museum.
This is something you turned
this
up
was
also.
Totally out of the blue.
Quite amazing.
Yeah. And she later had donated these manuscripts to the library of the Royal Institute of British Architects on my recommendation. But this was, again, one of the turning points in my research history on Gandhi, because this was an encyclopedic manuscript in which he explored what I'd described in the book as the mythography of architecture, and where he's very interested in the emergence of religion, the history of cults in the ancient world, and how that determined the evolution of architectural style throughout subsequent eons.
One of our own colleagues, Nick Adams, once told me when I was starting out on a written project that the thing I wanted to keep in mind was that I didn't want to write something about everything, and I didn't want to find myself writing everything about something either. But Gandhi here seems to have undertaken to have written everything about everything.
Yeah, it is a kind of encyclopedic undertaking. And quite honestly, I mean, he's something of an autodidact.
Yeah.
He has no formal education. He had a fundamental grasp of Italian and French. And so there's something, again, slightly maniacal about the nature of the manuscript and about his effort to encapsulate so much. Yeah. And, of course, he's related to Eliot's figure of Casaubon in Middlemarch, I make that citation. And there's something working there that's quite similar.
Except Casaubon is a figure for absolute dullness.
For ridicule and dullness. Gandhi does manage to bring it to life. Yeah,
There's nothing dull, I imagine.
There's definitely an imaginative esprit. And,
his family must have experienced a lot of the sublime just getting through the day.
I would imagine so, with him squirreled away in his study, writing about Persian mystery cults.
So can you tell us something about Gandhi's end, which was rather sad?
Well, this is another kind of sleuthing story about my serendipitous research techniques. Gandhi dies in 1843.
Christmas Day.
Nobody really knew about the circumstances of his death. His last exhibited picture at the Royal Academy is in 1838, and he basically vanishes at that point. I was able to pick up the trail of the circumstances of his death, and the end of Gandhi is rather sad, despairing in nature. Through a series of research inquiries and through the review of census documents at the Public Record Office in London, I was able to locate his whereabouts during the last 3 years of his life, and those whereabouts were a private lunatic asylum outside of Plymouth in the small village of Plympton St. Morris. And I had clues that he had died somewhere in the Plymouth area because he had ancestors centered in around Plymouth. And his son, who was a portraitist, had settled in Plymouth in the late 1830s. So I went around to all the Plymouth public record offices and asked for certificates of death for Joseph Gandhi in 43. And finally, I found it. And it indicated that his place of death was Plympton House Asylum. And so that led me on to a whole other research enterprise, which was to dig out material about this asylum. And indeed, through a review of official government House of Commons reports on the conditions of private insane asylums, in the 1840s, I was able to find rather dire accounts of the circumstances of Plympton House and its rather poor maintenance during the period when Gandhi was incarcerated there. And that's where he dies on Christmas Day 43 in this rather grim, privately administered insane asylum. Yeah.
You write rather poignantly about the irony of the fact that someone so consumed by the power of architectural remembrance should die without any record of where he's buried or any monument or tomb.
Despite all my best efforts, I've never found his grave. No. I've never found an obituary notice of Joseph Gandhi. He literally vanished without a trace, it seems. And as I said, a part of this strange 15-year adventure that was my research project on Gandhi was indeed covering this lost biography.
I wonder if we haven't here the basis for a possible architectural project, a competition perhaps sponsored by the Royal Academy out of restitution for the deplorable way Gandhi was often treated by the RA.
That's right, a cenotaph for Gandhi. A cast iron cenotaph.
Of course, I don't know what artists could do it. You know,
well, we could get all the losing competitors of the Ground Zero project.
Maybe Ray Harryhausen could do it.
That's right, Ray Harryhausen could do it. And it could be inhabited by all of his imaginary wax creatures.
It brings me to my last question, which I admit is a bit speculative, but I have this picture of you wandering the cemeteries of England looking for Gandhi's grave, and it struck me as a kind of emblem for the processes of research and scholarship, which of course have to do with memory. It's been said that a book is a kind of tombstone in its finality, in its attempt to sum something up. A library is a kind of necropolis. The rituals of conducting scholarly research have a pallid mortuary association. And I wonder, did you ever think of yourself in a way that Gandhi would have understood as engaged in a process of commemoration per se?
Well, it probably goes well beyond that. It's fair to say that I was probably possessed by Gandhi. And that if you come to visit me, I'm actually secretly in my dining room drawing architectural tombs day in, day out. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there was a degree of identification that went on over the long duration of my research on Gandhi. And I don't know, maybe there was a strange sense of morbid responsibility I felt toward him as the years went by in my effort to reconstruct both the extraordinary artistic corpus that he produced and also to give a poignant and yet accurate account of the circumstances, troubling as they are, of his life and times. And I want to emphasize that one of the projects within this book is not merely a saga about one man's tribulations. Gandhi, as you point out at the beginning, he was an extraordinary receptacle with respect to the cultural, social, and political dynamics of the period in which he lived.
Almost that, like that, a kind of artistic zealot.
That's right. That stretches from the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, into the age of industrialism, into the age of the March of Intellect. Yeah, now, he's not merely some oddball eccentric. Yeah. He did reflect in an extraordinary way the cultural vibrations and movements of this romantic period.
One thing Gandhi's interest in the notion of the ruin in the mutability and end of architecture makes clear is that all monuments are ultimately as evanescent as the things they commemorate. And I notice you mention, with respect to your own work in the beginning, that you expected to be superseded.
Right. First books on any subject are going to be subject to revision by future scholars. That's just part of the life cycle of knowledge and history. Right.
And all this begs another question about something so ingrained, maybe, to our experience that we failed to ask the question, which is, what is it that motivates us to do research and build libraries? Is it something that drives us to want to not only remember and reconstruct the past, but to commemorate, to render it memorable? Something we can ponder as we leaf through the illustrations of your book and the art of Joseph Gandhi. So I want to thank you, Brian, for joining us on this inaugural edition of the Library Cafe. The book we have been discussing is Joseph Gandhi, An Architectural Visionary in Georgian England by Brian Lukacher, Professor of Art at Vassar College. The book is published by Thames and Hudson.